Welcome. You're listening to the Mac Observer's Background Mode. This is your host, John Martellaro, and this week my guest is Mac Observer Editor-in-Chief Brian Chaffin.
Hi, John.
Hi.
Thanks for having me, man.
Hey, I was just thinking the other day, I think we've known each other for about 20 years. I think it was 1997 when you invited a few select people to write some special articles for the Mac Observer.
Yeah, I was a big fan of yours when you were writing for Apple Inks. And who else were you writing for back then?
Mostly Apple Inks. I think I might have been still writing for Mac Opinion, but maybe that had faded out by then. It was mostly Apple Inks.
I was a huge fan of what you were doing and some other people were doing. And I forget that series, but it was basically my sneaky way of getting some of these great writers over at TMO without actively poaching them.
Yeah, regrettably, Apple Inks is gone now. Joe Ryan shut it down a few years ago.
And you know, most of the peers that we had back then are gone.
Are you thinking somebody in particular?
Well, who's left?
Let's see.
I mean, there are definitely some sites that are left, but you know, the difference between 1997, 1998. So, yeah, I was writing for a website called Webintosh in 97.
I remember that.
And I ended up buying half of Webintosh from Dan Hughes, the young man who had started it. And the one thing I had learned about businesses that I needed someone like Dave Hamilton to handle the business side of things. So I sold half to Dave and we rebranded as the Mac Observer on December 28th, 1998. So it would have been like 1999 or 2000 or so when I would have asked you to do that series.
That was just before I went to work for Apple, which was something like August of 2000. Yeah. Oh, we had the three amigos at Apple Inks, Del Miller.
Yeah,
he comes over every year for Thanksgiving where he lives.
Does he really?
Now.
I didn't know that.
Yeah.
Oh, that's fantastic.
Good friend.
And oh my goodness! Tell him hi when you see him this year.
And then John Farr, of course, who's in Taos, and stay in contact with him. The three amigos. Yeah, Del was an amazing writer. I keep trying to get him to go back to writing, but.
You know, I have two. He threatened to accept that invitation once a couple of years ago, and nothing came of it, unfortunately. He's truly a gifted writer.
And then there was Charles Moore. I've lost track of Charles, too.
Yeah, Charles Moore ended up doing some. I had a politics site called The Philosophy Farm for a very, very short time. And Charles Moore did some writing for me there. He was, I think, the one lone conservative voice in a sea of liberal voices.
Good times.
Good times, yeah, for sure.
Well, one of the things I wanted to ask you about was the life and times of Mac Observer after, tell me the story of how TMO, in more detail, how you met Dave and what you were doing before that and what your inspirations were and what drove you to become a technical writer like some of the other people I've had on the show.
Well, I had a web development company in the mid-90s. And I met Dave. Dave was working for a company that did home and office computer repairs, in-home and office computer repairs. And we started working, my web development company started working with that company, ended up meeting Dave. And when I had the opportunity to buy Webintosh, I immediately thought, I actually tried to, not many people probably know this, but I tried to get Dave involved with my web development company.
This was in Austin, right?
This was in Austin, Texas, yeah. I wanted that help, wanted that business help. You know, I'm super good on the creative side. I'm not necessarily as good on the financial side of things. So Dave considered it, decided not to. But then when the Webintosh opportunity came up, he took me up on that. And, you know, it's been almost 19 years.
What are we going to do for the 20th anniversary?
I don't know.
You're buy us all Macs.
Yeah, probably not. Probably. I don't know. You get me enough traffic in between now and then, and I will definitely consider it.
I'm doing my best, sir.
I know. I know.
Particle debris, yeah. Keeps on slugging out of the park. Yeah.
Indeed.
So were you born and raised in Texas?
I was born in Houston. I was raised in Denton.
Isn't that near Dallas?
Yep, it's about 30 miles north of Dallas. It's the home of what is now the University of North Texas. But when I was a kid, it was North Texas State University. A small town in Texas with an enormous, I think there were 28,000 students at that time going to what was then called NTSU. And there was also Texas Woman's University that was there, TWU. So, big college town, exposed me to a lot of things that I wouldn't have had access to if Denton was the same city without those colleges.
What was your first computer? Was your first computer a Mac, or did you start off on a different brand?
Well, I took programming classes in high school. I took BASIC when I was a junior, and I took Pascal when I was a senior, and those would have been on Apple II, Apple IIe's at that point. But the first computer I owned was, are you ready?
Ready.
A TI-99/4A.
Oh, with a chiclet keyboard?
Yeah, I hated that thing. God, I hated that thing. The TI-99/4A was actually a remarkable computer, and it was $100. But it was just not very capable of doing much of anything. So, you get what you pay for.
I remember the computer magazines had a lot of bad things to say about that computer.
Well, there weren't many good things to say about the computer, but yeah, I had a cassette drive and had it hooked up to a TV for a CRT because you could do things like that back then. And that was the first one I owned. Didn't do a whole lot with it other than I made an automated D&D character rolling program because you need that,
of course,
to roll up your character stats. And did some things like that with it. I wanted the Apple IIe, but we couldn't afford it back then.
Were you reading the computer magazines like Mac Week and Mac World and Apple Insight? What was it? Mac Addict.
Most of those came around in the 90s or late 80s. I didn't own a computer again. So I guess I would have gotten the TI-99/4A in 1983. And it would have been 1995 when I owned my first Mac. And that was actually a Power Computing Power 100 clone.
Oh, a traitor in our midst.
Yeah, something like that.
Well, I had Bob Levitis on the show mm-hmm. a while back, and he talked about his life and times as, I think it was Power Computing salesman.
No, he was one of the marketing guys at Power Computing. He was a consultant. Bob worked with Mike Rosenfeld to develop a lot of the marketing campaigns that Power did. And Power was just a great marketing company, just a fantastic marketing company. They did so many. They really brought the sort of like spirit and life back to the Mac community.
They took a bite out of the apple.
They did. Yes, they did because they were doing so many things so much better than Apple was, and. The first book of Bob's that I read was Mac OS 7.6 for Dummies that came with my Power Computer Mac. So it was actually in the box with my Mac. And I remember that the thing that stands out for me in that book was the first for Dummies book I had read. And the thing that stands out for me is Bob explaining that what you need to do is you need to get about 562 different floppy drives, and you need to make a backup of your Mac on floppy drives every day. You need to have, and then one that you keep for a week that you rotate out, mm-hmm. and then another set that you take every month to your bank safety deposit box.
Right.
And all on floppy drives. That's what you need to do. And I was just thinking to myself, that just sounds crazy.
I remember doing a lot of floppy pushing and tugging in those days.
Yeah.
The first Mac. Yeah, fortunately.
Steve Jobs saved us from that.
How?
By getting rid of the floppy drive.
Oh, well, yeah.
Floppy drives were still commonly used when Steve did that.
You know, I don't remember how I backed up my early Macs. I had a 1984 Mac, and then I got a Big Mac, and then I went on to a Mac 2 color machine, and then I went on to a Centra 610, and then a Power Mac 8100. This was long before Time Machine, but were we doing hard disk backups?
Long before. This is like a decade or decade and a half before.
I think as soon as we had a SCSI drive, we could attach a drive and copy files, I think.
Yeah, but still, people were still using floppy drives to save files and to save programs and things like that. I mean, Steve Jobs really did move the needle when it comes to ditching that legacy technology.
We've come so far, you know. Like you said, in the early days, we were so delighted to take a computer and have an RF converter and attach it to a TV and actually see stuff happening on a color TV and messing with floppies. And then we sort of forget how long ago that was.
That's true. Have I ever told you the story about testing Power Computing's G3 prototype?
No.
So Mike Rosenfeld. I'm just like parts of the story just make me so mad. So Apple was being very slow. Apple was very slow to do anything new with Macs in the heyday of the clones. And the clones were a lot more nimble because they didn't have to make anywhere near as many units. And Power Computing in particular was really nimble. And one of the things that they would do is they would buy the best batch of processors from IBM or Motorola and then overclock them and then market them with that overclock speed. And another thing that they did, I still have the Motorola Power PC G3 prototype. I still have that one. But Mike Rosenfeld gave me the Power Center Pro, I think is what it was called, but it was their G3 model. And he told me I could test it because they were in this huge fight with Apple over whether or not they'd get to continue licensing. And Mike was really, really good at getting the press to do his PR work for him. So he gave me this thing and said, hey, do you want to test this? I'm like, of course I want to test this. So I tested it. I ran benchmarks. It was, you know, amazingly fast. It was just incredible. It was super duper cool. And he told me that I had to have it back by, I don't know, let's call it Monday. And he said, I had to have it back by Monday. I asked if I could have another day. He said, yeah. So Tuesday rolls around and I finished testing this thing. I put it back in its box. I drive up to Round Rock, which is where Power Computing was based. And I walk in the door and I ask for Mike, and everybody's looking at me funny. And they're like, he's not available right now. It's like, oh, well, I've got this G3 prototype that I'm supposed to return back. And then like their eyes just like go into saucer mode. And they like, apparently no one knew I had this thing. And so I give it back and go my merry way, you know, happy that I, you know, Mike had been adamant that I get it back on that Tuesday. And I come to find out he had walked out earlier that day.
You mean quit the company?
He had quit the company because they were going to sell to Apple, and he was protesting the agreement to sell to Apple. And long story short, if I hadn't taken the computer back, I could have kept it. No one knew I had it. No one in the company besides Mike knew that I had it. And I could have had this amazingly fast. I mean, it was just so much faster than any other Mac that was on the market. Just so much faster. And it was stable, and it was awesome. And I could, like, I just wish he'd like, you know, call me up. Hey, Brian. Yeah, you know, you can keep that thing if you want to.
There was a mentality during those days. It was a PowerPC processor. And there was this hubris that we had that it was an IBM chip and that Power PCs with their vector processors were somehow superior to these terrible Intel chips that were just shoddy and awful. And we really pat ourselves on the back. Remember those days?
Yeah.
When it was really cool to be different.
And it was cool to be different, and PowerPC was better than Intel, better than x86 at a lot of things, but there were some things that x86 were better at. And, you know, those of us who were in the Apple fan base, we would buy into Apple's shtick about how much more awesome it was.
Yeah. Well, guess what? It's time for a short break.
Okay.
When we come back, I want to talk to you about some of the projects you're working on and some current issues that Apple's going through right now, taxes and encryption. But first, this commercial break. Folks, stay with us. We'll be back in 60 seconds. I'm chatting with Brian Chaffin.
Hello there, all you fabulous Background Mode listeners. I'm Kelly Gamont with the Mac Observer, and I just want to say a few words about how you can support all the things we do. If you're thinking about buying something from Apple, Amazon, or Mac Mall, just go to the Mac Observer's homepage where we have a section called Support TMO. Or you can just enter macobserver.com/Apple Store, all one word, and that will take you to our special page for Apple and our other affiliates. If you make a purchase from one of our partners this way, the Mac Observer receives a small compensation for sending business their direction. Pretty cool, right? And you don't pay a penny more. This small fee from our affiliates helps us continue to bring you TMO's daily news, reviews, tips, how-tos, and podcasts like this one. So the next time you're thinking about an online purchase, come to TMO's homepage and support the Mac Observer. Thanks. Back to you, John.
Thanks, Kelly. I'm chatting with the Mac Observer's editor-in-chief and executive vice president, Brian Chaffin. So enough nostalgia. You told me before the show started that you were working on an article about this new resurgence of attack on iPhone encryption. Tell me about that.
This has been an issue in particular since the San Bernardino terrorist attack that happened in, goodness, was that 2015 now?
I think so.
And, the issue at the time, James Comey, the now fired FBI director, made the case publicly that it was a huge problem that he couldn't get into one of the iPhones that was recovered from from one of the two terrorists. I think it was his work iPhone. And in particular, this work iPhone was owned by the bad guy's employer. They gave the FBI permission to get into it. And the FBI couldn't because it was encrypted and it was locked. And Apple couldn't get into it because because of the encryption scheme that they use. Apple doesn't have the keys. There's no back door into these things. And so there was, this big debate about whether or not tech companies like Apple or Google or even platform providers like Facebook and WhatsApp and Twitter and whatnot should be providing backdoor access to law enforcement. And law enforcement wants this access. And those of us who actually understand how privacy or how encryption works don't want law enforcement to have it, only because if law enforcement has access to a backdoor, it's accessible by anyone. Backdoors accessible by anyone are accessible by everyone.
It's not technically feasible, so far as I know, to provide a backdoor that only works for selected people. Once the technology is in place for a backdoor, you think only authorized people can come in, but smart people figure out ways.
Yeah, exactly. So, encryption experts understand this. The scientists that work on encryption understand this. Apple understands this because it happens to employ some of these people. This is not rocket science. And it's also not new. We've gone through this debate over and over again. And there's this natural tension, a tension that I think should exist between law enforcement and the encryption world, where law enforcement's always going to want access, and the encryption folks say, well, you can't have access without endangering everybody's access.
Yeah, you made an important point there. Society is our culture, and our lawmakers have to come to a meeting of the minds of where the line is drawn. That's an important thing to do.
It is extremely important, and this is one of those situations where facts matter. And we sort of went through this debate at the time. Apple fought the FBI tooth and nail. FBI wanted Apple to create a version of iOS that would allow the FBI to bypass the encryption. So like basically they would sideload this version of iOS onto the smartphone, and that would bypass the encryption, and they would be able to get access to it. And Apple said, no, we're not going to do that. And then that fight, unfortunately, that fight did not resolve itself, because the FBI ended up withdrawing its request because they ended up paying an Israeli company something that's rumored to be $1 million to crack into this device.
And the other thing we worried about at the time was whether the FBI could actually keep this modified version of the operating system secure. And since then, we've had massive leaks from all sorts of agencies.
Yeah, that same company that developed this ended up leaving some of their technology behind on a compromised router somewhere.
And then there was the CIA leaks.
And the CIA leaks too. Yeah, it's all part of the same thing. And so the FBI, though, they were able to get into this phone. They didn't find anything, but that actually is irrelevant. That should not be used as an argument against backdoor access. Whether or not there was anything on this phone is not the point. The point is, if we want our phones protected from the bad guys, unfortunately, the good guys aren't going to be able to get into them either. And there are a lot more malicious criminal and state actors who want access to our smart devices. There are legions of them out there. And they are not bound by warrants. They are not bound by laws because they're bad guys.
But the public argument about this issue seems to be focused on law enforcement and not the delicacies of that argument you just presented. It's a complex subject, and it doesn't get discussed in that fashion in public discussions in the media.
Not very often, because it's hard. I mean, listen, it's real easy. Okay, like, should the FBI be able to get into the Texas shooting massacre's iPhone? Shooting massacre, the person who did the shooting, I didn't say that right, but should the FBI be able to get into that person's smartphone so that they can look for information on why he did this and how he planned it and things like that? Of course the FBI should be able to do that. And that's the easy surface level gut reaction. You know, like we all want the FBI to be able to get into this guy's smartphone so that they can, figure out what happened and maybe, you know, figure out if there's anyone else involved, et cetera.
You know what they say, that for every problem, there's an obvious, easy, and wrong solution.
Right. And that is exactly the case here. And so we are seeing the return of this false debate between encryption and privacy and safety, or is this debate between safety and privacy in regards to encryption. We're seeing a return of that because of the shooting in Texas, and it's happening around us again, and it's super frustrating from someone who knows, I at least know enough about encryption to get myself in trouble. But someone who knows that much about encryption, it's frustrating because it is a difficult issue and it doesn't get discussed very well in the media.
Oh, it doesn't.
And Congress people, like, you know, half of Congress has no understanding whatsoever, and the rest have some, you know, some understanding that ranges between knowing enough to get in trouble and actually knowing what they're talking about. And you'll find that, like, I was actually, to be honest, I was very pleasantly surprised during the hearings on this device, on this the San Bernardino's iPhone. I was pleasantly surprised to see that there were several congresspeople who did understand the issues.
And General Hayden, too, who came on TV and was a consultant and spoke eloquently about the issue and sided with Apple publicly.
Yes.
Former NSA director, former CIA director. General Hayden's very technically astute.
Extraordinarily. And he's also an articulate speaker. And hopefully he makes the rounds again this time if this debate picks up any more steam.
Okay, so let's move on. I want to talk about this business about Apple's taxes.
Okay.
I read just enough to know that there's this situation where Apple has taken advantage of government's opportunities to have Apple invest its money there and pay little tax. Apple has complied with the laws of those countries and taken advantage of opportunities to avoid paying taxes legally. And that's created somewhat of a fuss. Did I paraphrase that correctly?
Yeah, I'd probably tweak some of that. Like, Apple claims to be following the law. We're not attorneys. We don't. And the issue of international taxation and corporate structure is incredibly complex and difficult. But Apple claims to be following the law. And my best guess, as someone who follows Apple and follows technology companies and does my best to understand these things so that we can talk about them and write about them, I imagine Apple probably is following the law. I'd be flabbergasted if Apple was caught breaking a law. I would be flabbergasted if Apple has broken any laws.
I agree. They're just simply taking advantage of opportunities that are presented to them. And without an international treaty or international agreement on how multinational companies pay taxes, Apple's going to look out after its own best interest and pay all the legal taxes that it's required to pay and no more. I mean,
well, so we have an adversarial system, right? Our taxes are essentially an adversarial system, in part because the tax codes are so complex that there are loopholes. And in some cases, you know, stuff's just written. It's not even a loophole. It's just written into the laws. And it's extraordinary.
Tim Cook was in front of Congress, what, about a year ago?
And he said, a year and a half.
Yeah, and he said something like, if I remember correctly, if you want Apple to pay more taxes, change the law.
Well, he said very specifically, and this is something that Apple is repeating again, we follow the law. If you want us to do things differently, change the law.
Mm-hmm.
That is his argument. And there's an important aspect of it. So first of all, I'm of two minds of this. I believe that Apple is following the law. We certainly have never had any evidence ever suggesting otherwise, ever, by anyone. And I believe that Apple is following the law. I also, however, believe that companies need to pay taxes to be good corporate citizens. Companies benefit from society, and they benefit from an educated society. They benefit from the roads that allow workers to be able to get to work. In the case of Apple, Apple benefits from roads that allow customers to get to their wonderful Apple stores.
But the problem is that Apple is a company that does a lot of its business overseas in different countries with different laws, and they simply shop around to find the best way to manage their money amidst all the different countries they do business in. It's not just a U.S. thing.
Well, okay, to that effect, and there's, again, there's so many issues here, John. There's local taxes and there's national taxes and there's taxes that are paid abroad or not paid abroad. Apple actually is a massive taxpayer in the U.S. Apple says it's the largest taxpayer in the U.S. And Apple also says it's the largest taxpayer in the world. Apple says that it's paid $35 billion in taxes over the last 3 years and set aside an additional $36 billion during the same 3 years to cover tax liabilities on profits earned overseas that currently sit offshore. And where some of this starts becoming a little bit messy is that people think that money being held offshore has been moved offshore in order to dodge taxes. That's not what Apple does. Apple actually pays a lot of money on all the business that it does here in the U.S.
Yes.
Now, Apple also goes to local cities and state governments and county taxing districts, et cetera, and asks for special tax breaks in order to locate a facility or, you know, a building or a factory or in the case of Austin, Apple Care facilities, things like that. They'll look for tax breaks to locate their operations in a given city. Every single company does this. This is something that I think is wrong. I think that it's wrong for the companies to do it, and I think that it's wrong for the local governments to be offering these deals, but it happens. And a tremendous argument could be made that Apple has a legal responsibility to get every single deal like that it can. And then at the same time, so if like anyone in the U.S. complaining about taxes that Apple's paying in the U.S., they're probably wrong to do so because they're not understanding what's going on. What Apple is really doing that is getting the ire of foreign governments is that Apple positions and structures its companies so that profits from overseas sales are the profits themselves accrue in low taxation countries. And when those profits accrue in the low taxation country, Apple isn't paying very much in any kind of income tax in the countries where these sales and business is being generated.
It's a natural thing to do. Yeah, countries don't want that situation to be in effect, then change the rules.
But Apple then still owes money on those profits to the U.S. That's the thing that people forget. And the reason why Apple wants to do this is because as long as Apple leaves this money sitting outside the U.S., it doesn't have to pay those taxes. So that the $36 billion that Apple has set aside for tax liabilities, Apple's still earning money on that $36 billion.
Of course.
Right? So
complex
the real,
issue.
The real place that Apple is, in my opinion, doing anybody's wrong is when it's earning a lot of money for selling devices or services in, say, Germany, but is not paying very much, if anything, in income tax in Germany. Apple is still going to owe income tax on that, and they're going to owe that tax to the U.S. But the way everything is set up, Apple can leave that money sitting outside the U.S. and never actually have to pay those income taxes.
Okay. Can we leave it there?
Sure.
All right. So we've beaten that to death. The last thing I wanted to talk to you about, we were talking about earlier, was the life and times of Brian and your writing. And you told me the other day that, well, in addition to the non-fiction books, the technical books that you've worked with, the book Incredible iPad Apps for Dummies with Bob Levitis, and you've also worked on iPad for Dummies, the 10th revision. So you've got your name on a couple of books, and you've been working on writing and selling technical books. Tell me a little bit about that, and then tell me about your fiction work. We'll wrap up with science fiction.
Okay, well, first of all, I got to give hats off to Bob Levitis. Bob has been very kind to me professionally over the years. He writes for us here at the Mac Observer. He has also invited me to be a part of several For Dummies projects. I tech edited GarageBand for Dummies. I wrote two of the chapters that, frankly, Bob rewrote, but that's beside the point. And I did I contributed some chapters to did I do some chapters in Incredible iPhone Apps for Dummies? I think I did. But then I wrote half of Incredible iPad Apps for Dummies. And I contributed a bunch to the first edition of the iPad All-in-One book. Most recently, just a couple of weeks ago, I finished wrapping up a rewrite of iPad for Dummies for the 10th edition to be updated for iOS 11 and the new iPads.
Cool. Can I ask you, if I may, how the royalties work out on that? Do you agree with Bob on a certain percentage split? Is that how it works?
With all of those projects, I've been a writer for hire.
Oh, so it's fixed cost?
Yeah. I got fixed sums for doing all of those projects. I would imagine that the next book I'll be doing for Wiley, because I haven't signed the contract yet, but I have had an agent offer to rep me for nonfiction work. I'm super excited by that.
Ooh, so congratulations.
Thank you. I'm very excited by that. So I would imagine that future projects will involve royalties. But the reality is that there's not a ton of money in the nonfiction book world. So royalties, you don't really earn royalties on as a nonfiction book the way it works unless they actually earn out everything that they paid for in the with the original work for hire.
I had Maria Langer on the show, and she said after years and years of writing paper technical books that she decided to get out of that. It got to be kind of a tough business to be in. But it also gets your name in print and makes some money.
Sure, yeah, and, you know, it's fun to do. I learned a lot about iOS 11 from having to go through that book, to be honest. So that's and that's obviously helped me for everything we do at TMO.
So you've also written, you're working on a draft of a science fiction novel, or it's completed, I should say. Tell me about your science fiction novel. I know it isn't published yet.
It's not published yet. I am shopping it out to agents. The way the fiction world works, like for a nonfiction book, you actually sell it before you write it. And with the fiction world, you have to write it before you can sell it. It's kind of like the exact opposite. And so I've written the book. I've rewritten the book. I've edited the book. I've rewritten it again. I threw it away and started over and rewrote it again. And I'm at the point now where I'm quite happy with it. And I'm doing something called querying, where you send a query to an agent and mm-hmm. pitch them your book. And that's been a long process. I've gotten a lot of rejections. I've also gotten lots of requests where the agent asks for material to read. I've got two full requests out with agents right now that I'm waiting to hear back from. Could be weeks or months before I do. And yeah.
Well, good luck with that. Have you thought about going the Amazon route, like The Martian?
Yes. If I can't get a publishing deal, I will self-publish. I want a publishing deal, not only for my own ego, but from the standpoint of I want professional help to become a better writer, and I want my book to be as good as it possibly can be. And the reality is that self-published books do not get the time and attention that that books that have gone through the publishing process go through. And I'm not saying that every published book is better than every self-published book. I'm not saying that by any stretch of the imagination. As a matter of fact, I've read a lot of terrible books that have been published recently. Like in the last 3 years, it seems like almost every book that I pick up is just bad. And that's super frustrating. But I want to get the help. I want the help from an agent to make my work better, and I want the help of publishing editors to make my work better. And in particular, I want to get that help while it still has a lot of value. The publishing world does still have a lot of cachet that's associated with it. And I want to take advantage of that while it still has that value. And if I can't get an agent, and if my agent can't sell the book to a publisher, I would eventually self-publish for sure.
Well, I read that I'm not anywhere near where you are, but I read once that your first book is sort of like your business card. It's proof that you can do it, and it launches your career. And after you've written your third or fourth novel, you look back and you go, oh, boy, that was a learning experience. So,
I think that's true for most creative endeavors. Most first books, like 99% of first books never see the light of day because they're just not good.
You gotta get it out of your system.
You gotta get it out of your system. There's so much to learn about writing. Yeah. It is such an incredibly long and grueling process. And there's always more to learn. And I am sure that if I get to the point where I've written a third or fourth work of fiction, that I will in fact rue that this the Accidental Intelligence is the name of the book that it ever saw the light of day.
Well, there is a privately owned chain of bookstores in Denver doing rather well, actually, called The Tattered Cover. So I can't wait to walk into The Tattered Cover someday and go to the science fiction section and grab one of your hardbacks. That'll be great.
Thank you. Aren't you sweet?
That'll be great. Hey, guess what? We're out of time.
Oh,
I think we covered everything we were planning to cover. Thanks to my incredible timing.
Of course. Of course. You're an excellent host, John.
Oh, you're very welcome. Thank you. Tell the listeners how they can contact you. I'm sure they know already, but remind them.
Well, I am, of course, at MacObserver.com. You can find me on Twitter at TMOBrian. That's Brian with a Y. And you can also hit me up on Instagram at GeekTells, GeekTells. And my personal blog is at GeekTells.com.
Excellent, excellent. Well, it was nice having this fireside chat with you. We've known each other for like 12 years, but we've never really had a chance to go on the air and chat like this and let our hair down. So it was fun.
I think you've been writing for me for 12 years, but we've known each other for 20.
That's right. That's right. It's amazing. So thanks again. It was delightful to have you on the show, and good luck with your writing.
Thanks very much, John. I really appreciate you having me.
Looking forward to that 20th anniversary present, too. Okay, folks, I hope you enjoyed the show. We'll be back next week. You've been listening to the Mac Observer's Background Mode.